problem in his own way by developing the strategy of distraction that has served people of wealth ever since. He became the most illustrious patron of the arts that history has ever known. Not only did he spend lavishly on paintings, he created Italy's finest apprentice schools for young artists. It was in one of these schools that the young Michelangelo first caught the attention of Lorenzo, who invited the artist to come and live in his house. He did the same with Leonardo da Vinci. Once under his wing, Michelangelo and Leonardo requited his generosity by becoming loyal artists in his stable. Whenever Lorenzo faced an enemy, he would wield the weapon of patronage. When Pisa, Florence's traditional enemy, threatened to rebel against it in 1472, Lorenzo placated its people by pouring money into its university, which had once been its pride and joy, but had long ago lost its luster. The Pisans had no defense against this insidious maneuver, which simultaneously fed their love of culture and blunted their desire for battle. Interpretation. Lorenzo undoubtedly loved the arts, but his patronage of artists had a practical function as well, of which he was keenly aware. In Florence at the time, banking was perhaps the least admired way of making money, and was certainly not a respected source of power. The arts were at the other pole, the pole of quasi-religious transcendence. By spending on the arts, Lorenzo deluded people's opinions of the ugly source of his wealth, disguising himself in nobility. There is no better use of strategic generosity than that of distracting attention from an unsavory reality and wrapping oneself in the mantle of art or religion. Observance number 4. Louis XIV had an eagle eye for the strategic power of money. When he came to the throne, the powerful nobility had recently proven a thorn on the monarchy's side and seethed with rebelliousness. So he impoverished these aristocrats by making them spend enormous sums on maintaining their position in the court. Making them dependent on royal largesse for their livelihood, he had them in his claws. Next, Louis brought the nobles to their knees with strategic generosity. It would work like this. Whenever he noticed a stubborn courtier whose influence he needed to gain, or whose troublemaking he needed to squelch, he would use his vast wealth to soften the soil. First he would ignore his victim, making the man anxious. Then the man would suddenly find that his son had been given a well-paid post, or that funds had been spent liberally in his home region, or that he had been given a painting he had long coveted. Presents would flow from Louis's hands. Finally, weeks or months later, Louis would ask for the favor he had needed all along. A man who had once vowed to do anything to stop the king would find he had lost the desire to fight. A straightforward bribe would have made him rebellious. This was far more insidious. Facing hardened earth in which nothing could take root, Louis loosened the soil before he planted his seeds. Interpretation. Louis understood that there is a deep-rooted emotional element in our attitude to money, an element going back to childhood. When we're children, all kinds of complicated feelings about our parents center around gifts. We see the giving of a gift as a sign of love and approval, and that emotional element never goes away. The recipients of gifts, financial or otherwise, are suddenly as vulnerable as children, especially when the gift comes from someone in authority. They cannot help opening up. Their will is loosened, as Louis loosened the soil. To succeed best, the gift should come out of the blue. It should be remarkable for the fact that a gift like it has never been given before, or for being preceded by a cold shoulder from the giver. The more often you give to particular people, the blunter this weapon becomes. If they don't take your gifts for granted, becoming monsters of ingratitude, they will resent what appears to be charity. The sudden, unexpected, one-time gift will not spoil your children. It will keep them under your thumb. Observance number 5. The antique dealer Fushimiya, who lived in the city of Edo, former name for Tokyo, in the 17th century, once made a stop at a village tea house. After enjoying a cup of tea, he spent several minutes scrutinizing the cup, which he eventually paid for and took away with him. A local artisan watching this waited until Fushimiya left the shop. then approached the old woman who owned the tea house and asked her who this man was. She told him it was Japan's most famous connoisseur, antique dealer to the Lord of Izumo. The artisan ran out of the shop, caught up with Fushimiya, and begged him to sell him the cup, which must clearly be valuable if Fushimiya judged it so. Fushimiya laughed heartily. "It's just an ordinary cup of bizenware," he explained, "and it is not valuable at all. The reason I was looking at it was that the steam seemed to hang about it strangely, and I wondered if there was a leak somewhere." Devotees of the tea ceremony were interested in any odd or accidental beauty in nature. Since the artisan still seemed so excited about it, Fushimiya gave him the cup for free. The artisan took the cup around, trying to find an expert who would appraise it at a high price. But since all of them recognized it as an ordinary teacup, he got nowhere. Soon he was neglecting his own business, thinking only of the cup and the fortune it could bring. Finally, he went to Edo to talk to Fushimiya at his shop. There, the dealer, realizing that he had inadvertently caused this man pain by making him believe the cup had great worth, paid him 100 ryo, gold pieces, for the cup as a kindness. The cup was indeed mediocre, but he wanted to rid the artisan of his obsession, while also allowing him to feel that his effort had not been wasted. The artisan thanked him and went on his way. Soon word spread of Fushimiya's purchase of the teacup. Every dealer in Japan clamored for him to sell it, since a cup he had bought for 100 ryo must be worth much more. He tried to explain the circumstances in which he had bought the cup, but the dealers could not be dissuaded. Fushimiya finally relented and put the cup up for sale. During the auction, two buyers simultaneously bid 200 ryo for the teacup, and then began to fight over who had bid first. Their fighting tipped over a table, and the teacup fell to the ground and broke into several pieces. The auction was clearly over. Fushimiya glued and mended the cup, then stored it away, thinking the affair finished. Years later, however, the great tea master Matsudaira Fumai visited the store and asked to see the cup, which by then had become legendary. Fumai examined it. "As a piece," he said, "it is not up to much. But a tea master prizes sentiment and association more than intrinsic value." He bought the cup for a high sum. A glued-together work of less than ordinary craftsmanship had become one of the most famous objects in Japan. Interpretation. The story shows, first, an essential aspect of money, that it is humans who have created it, and humans who instill it with meaning and value. Second, with objects, as with money, what the courier most values are the sentiments and emotions embedded in them. These are what make them worth having. The lesson is simple. The more your gifts and your acts of generosity play with sentiment, the more powerful they are. The object or concept that plays with a charged emotion or hits a chord of sentiment has more power than the money you squander on an expensive yet lifeless present. Observance number 6. Akimoto Susutomo, a wealthy adherent of the tea ceremony, once gave his page 100 ryo, gold pieces, and instructed him to purchase a tea bowl offered by a particular dealer. When the page saw the bowl, he doubted it was worth that much, and after much bargaining got the price reduced to 95 ryo. Days later, after Susutomo had put the bowl to use, the page proudly told him what he had done. "What an ignoramus you are," replied Susutomo. "A tea bowl that anyone asks 100 pieces of gold for can only be a family heirloom, and a thing like that is only sold when the family is pressed for money. And in that case, they will be hoping to find someone who will give them even 150 pieces for it. So what sort of fellow is it who does not consider their feelings? Quite apart from that, a curio that you give 100 ryo for is something worth having, but one that has only cost 95 gives a mean impression. So never let me see that tea bowl again." And he had the bowl locked away and never took it out. Interpretation. When you insist on paying less, you may save your 5 ryo, but the insult you cause and the cheap impression you create will cost you in reputation, which is the thing the powerful prize above all. Learn to pay the full price. It will save you a lot in the end. Observance number 7. Sometime near the beginning of the 17th century in Japan, a group of generals whiled away the time before a big battle by staging an incense-smelling competition. Each participant anteed up a prize for the contest's winners. Bows, arrows, saddles, and other items a warrior would covet. The great lord Date Masamune happened to pass by and was induced to participate. For a prize, he offered the gourd that hung from his belt. Everyone laughed, for no one wanted to win this cheap item. A retainer of the host finally accepted the gourd. When the party broke up, however, and the generals were chatting outside the tent, Masamune brought over his magnificent horse and gave it to the retainer. "There," he said, "a horse has come out of the gourd." The stunned general suddenly regretted their scorn at Masamune's gift. Interpretation. Masamune understood the following. Money gives its possessor the ability to give pleasure to others. The more you can do this, the more you attract admiration. When you can make a horse come out of a gourd, you give the ultimate demonstration of your power. Reversal. The powerful never forget that what is offered for free is inevitably a trick. Friends who offer favors without asking for payment will later want something far dearer than the money you would have paid them. The bargain has hidden problems, both material and psychological. Learn to pay, then, and to pay well. On the other hand, this law offers great opportunities for swindling and deception, if you apply it from the other side. Dangling the lure of a free lunch is the con artist's stock in trade. No man was better at this than the most successful con artist of our age, Joseph Weil, a.k.a. the Yellow Kid. The Yellow Kid learned early that what made his swindles possible was his fellow human's greed. "This desire to get something for nothing," he once wrote, "has been very costly to many people who have dealt with me and with other con men. When people learn, as I doubt they will, that they can't get something for nothing, crime will diminish, and we shall all live in greater harmony." Over the years, Weil devised many ways to seduce people with a prospect of easy money. He would hand out free real estate. Who could resist such an offer? And then the suckers would learn they had to pay $25 to register the sale. Since the land was free, it seemed worth the high fee, and the Yellow Kid would make thousands of dollars on the phony registration. In exchange, he would give his suckers a phony deed. Other times he would tell suckers about a fixed horse race or a stock that would earn 200% in a few weeks. As he spun his stories, he would watch the suckers' eyes open wide at the thought of a free lunch. The lesson is simple. Bait your deceptions with the possibility of easy money. People are essentially lazy and want wealth to fall in their lap rather than to work for it. For a small sum, sell them advice on how to make millions. P.T. Barnum did this later in life. And that small sum will become a fortune when multiplied by thousands of suckers. Lure people in with a prospect of easy money, and you have the room to work still more deceptions on them, since greed is powerful enough to blind your victims to anything. And as the Yellow Kid said, half the fun is teaching a moral lesson. Greed does not pay. Here are some further reflections on this law. From the Muqaddimah, Ibn Khaldun, Buried Treasure. Many weak-minded persons in cities hope to discover property under the surface of the earth and to make some profit from it. In the Maghrib, there are many Berbers students who are unable to make a living by natural ways and means. They approach well-to-do people with papers that have torn margins and contain either non-Arabic writing or what they claim to be the translation of a document written by the owner of buried treasures, giving the clue to the hiding place. In this way, they try to get their sustenance by persuading the well-to-do to send them out to dig and hunt for treasure. Occasionally, one of these treasure hunters displays strange information or some remarkable trick of magic with which he fools people into believing his other claims, although in fact he knows nothing of magic and its procedures. The things that have been said about treasure hunting have no scientific basis, nor are they based on factual information. It should be realized that although treasures are found, this happens rarely and by chance, not by systematic search. Those who are deluded or afflicted by these things must take refuge in God from their inability to make a living and their laziness in this respect. They should not occupy themselves with absurdities and untrue stories. From the Fables of Aesop, The Miser. A miser, to make sure of his property, sold all that he had and converted it into a great lump of gold, which he hid in a hole in the ground, and went continually to visit and inspect it. This roused the curiosity of one of his workmen, who, suspecting that there was a treasure, when his master's back was turned, went to the spot and stole it away. When the miser returned and found the place empty, he wept and tore his hair. But a neighbor who saw him in this extravagant grief and learned the cause of it said, "Fret thyself no longer, but take a stone and put it in the same place, and think that it is your lump of gold. For as you never meant to use it, the one will do as much good as the other." The worth of money is not in its possession, but in its use. From The Unspoken Way by Michihiro Matsumoto. There is a popular saying in Japan that goes, "Tadayori taki mono wanai," meaning, "Nothing is more costly than something given free of charge." From The Dermis Probe, Idris Shaw. Money. Yusuf ibn Jafar il-Amudi used to take sums of money, sometimes very large ones, from those who came to study with him. A distinguished legalist visiting him once said, "I am enchanted and impressed by your teachings, and I am sure that you are directing your disciples in a proper manner. But it is not in accordance with tradition to take money for knowledge. Besides, the action is open to misinterpretation." El-Amudi said, "I have never sold any knowledge. There is no money on earth sufficient to pay for it. As for misinterpretation, the abstaining from taking money will not prevent it, for it will find some other object. Rather, you should know that a man who takes money may be greedy for money, or he may not. But a man who takes nothing at all is under the gravest suspicion of robbing the disciple of his soul. People who say, 'I take nothing,' may be found to take away the volition of their victim." From a Chinese Fable, The Man Who Loved Money Better Than Life. In ancient times there was an old woodcutter who went to the mountain almost every day to cut wood. It was said that this old man was a miser who hoarded his silver until it changed to gold, and that he cared more for gold than anything else in all the world. One day a wilderness tiger sprang at him, and though he ran, he couldn't escape, and the tiger carried him off in its mouth. The woodcutter's son saw his father's danger and ran to save him, if possible. He carried a long knife, and as he could run faster than the tiger, who had a man to carry, he soon overtook them. His father was not much hurt, for the tiger held him by his clothes. When the old woodcutter saw his son about to stab the tiger, he called out in great alarm, "Do not spoil the tiger's skin! Do not spoil the tiger's skin! If you can kill him without cutting holes in his skin, we can get many pieces of silver for it. Kill him, but do not cut his body." While the son was listening to his father's instructions, the tiger suddenly dashed off into the forest, carrying the old man where the son could not reach him, and he was soon killed. From The Book of Government, or Rules for Kings, by Nizam al-Mulk. The Story of Moses and Pharaoh. It is written in the histories of the prophets that Moses was sent to Pharaoh with many miracles, wonders, and honors. Now the daily ration for Pharaoh's table was 4,000 sheep, 400 cows, 200 camels, and a corresponding amount of chickens, fish, beverages, fried meats, sweets, and other things. All the people of Egypt and all his army used to eat at his table every day. For 400 years he had claimed divinity and never ceased providing this food. When Moses prayed, saying, "O Lord, destroy Pharaoh," God answered his prayer and said, "I shall destroy him in water, and I shall bestow all his wealth and that of his soldiers on you and your peoples. Several years passed by after this promise, and Pharaoh, doomed to ruin, continued to live in all his magnificence. Moses was impatient for God to destroy Pharaoh quickly, and he couldn't endure to wait any longer. So he fasted for 40 days and went to Mount Sinai, and in his communing with God he said, O Lord, thou didst promise that thou wouldst destroy Pharaoh, and still he has forsaken none of his blasphemies and pretensions. So when wilt thou destroy him? A voice came from the truth, saying, O Moses, you want me to destroy Pharaoh as quickly as possible. But 1,000 times 1,000 of my servants want me never to do so, because they partake of his bounty and enjoy tranquility under his rule. By my power I swear that as long as he provides abundant food and comfort for my creatures, I shall not destroy him. Moses said, Then when will thy promise be fulfilled? God said, My promise will be fulfilled when he withholds his provision from my creatures. If ever he begins to lessen his bounty, know that his hour is drawing near. It chanced that one day Pharaoh said to Haman, Moses has gathered the sons of Israel about him, and is causing us disquiet. We know not what will be the issue of his affair with us. We must keep our stores full, lest at any time we be without resources. So we must have our daily rations and keep the saving in reserve. He deducted 2,000 sheep, 200 cows, and 100 camels, and similarly every 2 or 3 days reduced the ration. Moses then knew that the promise of the truth was near to fulfillment, for excessive economy is a sign of decline and a bad omen. The masters of tradition say that on the day when Pharaoh was drowned, only 2 ewes had been killed in his kitchen. Nothing is better than generosity. If a man is rich and desires, without a royal charter, to act like a lord, if he wants men to humble themselves before him, to revere him and call him lord and prince, then tell him every day to spread a table with victuals. All those who have acquired renown in the world have gained it mainly through hospitality, while the miserly and avaricious are despised in both worlds. From the Histories of Herodotus, The Flame-Colored Cloak. During the campaign of Cambyses in Egypt, a great many Greeks visited that country for one reason or another. Some, as was to be expected, for trade, some to serve in the army, others, no doubt, out of mere curiosity, to see what they could see. Amongst the sightseers was Eaces, son of Silosen, the exiled brother of Polycrates of Samos. While he was in Egypt, Silosen had an extraordinary stroke of luck. He was hanging about the streets of Memphis, dressed in a flame-colored cloak, when Darius, who at that time was a member of Cambyses' guard, and not yet of any particular importance, happened to catch sight of him, and, seized with a sudden longing to possess the cloak, came up to Silosen and made him an offer for it. His extreme anxiety to get it was obvious enough to Silosen, who was inspired to say, I am not selling this for any money, but if you must have it, I will give it to you for free. Darius thereupon thanked him warmly and took it. Silosen at the moment merely thought he had lost it by his foolish good nature. Then came the death of Cambyses, and the revolt of the 7 against the Magus. And Darius ascended the throne. Silosen now had the news that the man whose request for the flame-colored cloak he had formerly gratified in Egypt had become king of Persia. He hurried to Susa, sat down at the entrance of the royal palace, and claimed to be included in the official list of the king's benefactors. The sentry on guard reported his claim to Darius, who asked in surprise who the man might be. For surely, he said, as I have so recently come to the throne, there cannot be any Greek to whom I am indebted for a service. Hardly any of them have been here yet, and I certainly cannot remember owing anything to a Greek. But bring him in all the same, that I may know what he means by this claim. The guard escorted Silosen into the royal presence, and when the interpreters asked him who he was and what he had done to justify the statement that he was the king's benefactor, he reminded Darius of the story of the cloak, and said that he was the man who had given it to him. "Sir," exclaimed Darius, "you are the most generous of men. For while I was still a person of no power or consequence, you gave me a present. Small indeed, but deserving then as much gratitude from me as with the most splendid of gifts today. I will give you in return more silver and gold than you can count, that you may never regret that you once did a favor to Darius, the son of Hystaspes. My lord, replied Silosan, do not give me gold or silver, but recover Samos for me, my native island, which now since Oretes killed my brother Polycrates is in the hands of one of our servants. Let Samos be your gift to me, but let no man in the island be killed or enslaved. Darius consented to Silosan's request, and dispatched a force under the command of Otanes, one of the seven, with orders to do everything that Silosan had asked. From Arthur Schopenhauer. Money is never spent to so much advantage as when you have been cheated out of it, for at one stroke you have purchased prudence. From Han Fei Tzu. A Gift of Fish. Gung Yi Shuo, Premier of Lu, was fond of fish. Therefore people in the whole country conscientiously bought fish, which they presented to him. However, Kung Yi would not accept the presents. Against such a step, his younger brother remonstrated with him and said, "You like fish indeed. Why don't you accept the present of fish?" In reply, he said, "It is solely because I like fish that I would not accept the fish they gave me. Indeed, if I accept the fish, I will be placed under an obligation to them. Once placed under an obligation to them, I will sometime have to bend the law. If I bend the law, I will be dismissed from the premiership. After being dismissed from the premiership, I might not be able to supply myself with fish. On the contrary, if I do not accept the fish from them and am not dismissed the premiership, however fond of fish, I can always supply myself with fish." From Yellow Kid Wild. I took money only from those who could afford it and were willing to go in with me in schemes they fancied would fleece others. They wanted money for its own sake. I wanted it for the luxuries and pleasures it would afford me. They were seldom concerned with human nature. They knew little and cared less about their fellow men. If they had been keener students of human nature, if they had given more time to companionship with their fellows and less to the chase of the almighty dollar, they wouldn't have been such easy marks. The 41st Law. Avoid stepping into a great man's shoes. Judgment. What happens first always appears better and more original than what comes after. If you succeed a great man or have a famous parent, you will have to accomplish double their achievements to outshine them. Do not get lost in their shadow, or stuck in a past not of your own making. Establish your own name and identity by changing course. Slay the overbearing father, disparage his legacy, and gain power by shining in your own way. Transgression of the law. When Louis XIV died in 1715, after a glorious 55-year reign, all eyes focused on his great-grandson and chosen successor, the future Louis XV. Would the boy, only five at the time, prove as great a leader as the Sun King? Louis XIV had transformed a country on the verge of civil war into the preeminent power in Europe. The last years of his reign had been difficult. He had been old and tired. But it was hoped that the child would develop into the kind of strong ruler who would reinvigorate the land and add to the firm foundation that Louis XIV had laid. To this end, the child was given the best minds of France as his tutors, men who would instruct him in the arts of statecraft, in the methods that the Sun King had perfected. Nothing was neglected in his education. But when Louis XV came to the throne in 1726, a sudden change came over him. He no longer had to study or please others or prove himself. He stood alone at the top of a great country, with wealth and power at his command. He could do as he wished. In the first years of his reign, Louis gave himself over to pleasure, leaving the government in the hands of a trusted minister, André Hercule de Fleury. This caused little concern, for he was a young man who needed to sow his wild oats, and de Fleury was a good minister. but it slowly became clear that this was more than a passing phase. Louis had no interest in governing. His main worry was not France's finances or a possible war with Spain, but boredom. He couldn't stand being bored. And when he was not hunting deer or chasing young girls, he whiled away his time at the gambling tables, losing huge sums in a single night. The court, as usual, reflected the tastes of the ruler. Gambling and lavish parties became the obsession. The courtiers had no concern for the future of France. They poured their energies into charming the king, angling for titles that would bring them life pensions, and for cabinet positions demanding little work but paying huge salaries. Parasites flocked to the court, and the state's debts swelled. In 1745, Louis fell in love with Madame de Pompadour, a woman of middle-class origin who had managed to rise through her charms, her intelligence, and a good marriage. Madame de Pompadour became the official royal mistress. She also became France's arbiter of taste and fashion. But the Madame had political ambitions as well, and she eventually emerged as the country's unofficial prime minister. It was she, not Louis, who wielded hiring and firing power over France's most important ministers. As he grew older, Louis only needed more diversion. On the grounds of Versailles, he built a brothel, Parc Corsaire, which housed some of the prettiest young girls of France. Underground passages and hidden staircases gave Louis access at all hours. After Madame de Pompadour died in 1764, she was succeeded as royal mistress by Madame du Barry, who soon came to dominate the court, and who, like de Pompadour before her, began to meddle in affairs of state. If a minister did not please her, he would find himself fired. All of Europe was aghast when du Barry, the daughter of a baker, managed to arrange the firing of Étienne de Choiseul, the foreign minister and France's most able diplomat. He had shown her too little respect. As time went by, swindlers and charlatans made their nests in Versailles and enticed Louis's interest in astrology, the occult, and fraudulent business deals. The young and pampered teenager who had taken over France years before had only grown worse with age. The motto that became attached to Louis's reign was, "Après moi, le déluge." After me, the flood. Or, let France rot after I'm gone. And indeed, when Louis did go in 1774, worn out by debauchery, his country and his own finances were in horrible disarray. His grandson Louis the 16th inherited a realm in desperate need of reform and a strong leader. But Louis the 16th was even weaker than his grandfather, and could only watch as the country descended into revolution. In 1792, the Republic introduced by the French Revolution declared the end of the monarchy, and gave the king a new name, Louis the Last. A few months later, he kneeled on the guillotine, his about-to-be-severed head stripped of all the radiance and power that the Sun King had invested in the crown. Interpretation. From a country that had descended into civil war in the late 1640s, Louis XIV forged the mightiest realm in Europe. Great generals would tremble in his presence. A cook once made a mistake in preparing a dish and committed suicide rather than face the king's wrath. Louis XIV had many mistresses, but their power ended in the bedroom. He filled his court with the most brilliant minds of the age. The symbol of his power was Versailles. Refusing to accept the palace of his forefathers, the Louvre, he built his own palace in what was then the middle of nowhere, symbolizing that this was a new order he had founded, one without precedent. He made Versailles the centerpiece of his reign, a place that all the powerful of Europe envied and visited with a sense of awe. In essence, Louis took a great void, the decaying monarchy of France, and filled it with his own symbols and radiant power. Louis the 15th, on the other hand, symbolizes the fate of all those who inherit something large or who follow in a great man's footsteps. It would seem easy for a son or successor to build on the grand foundation left for them. But in the realm of power, the opposite is true. The pampered, indulged son almost always squanders the inheritance, for he doesn't start with the father's need to fill a void. As Machiavelli states, necessity is what impels men to take action. and once the necessity is gone, only rot and decay are left. Having no need to increase his store of power, Louis XV inevitably succumbed to inertia. Under him, Versailles, the symbol of the Sun King's authority, became a pleasure palace of incomparable banality, a kind of Las Vegas of the Bourbon monarchy. It came to represent all that the oppressed peasantry of France hated about their king, and during the Revolution they looted it with glee. Louis XV had only one way out of the trap awaiting the son or successor of a man like the Sun King: to psychologically begin from nothing, to denigrate the past and his inheritance, and to move in a totally new direction, creating his own world. Assuming you have the choice, it would be better to avoid the situation altogether, to place yourself where there is a vacuum of power, where you can be the one to bring order out of chaos without having to compete with another star in the sky. Power depends on appearing larger than other people. And when you are lost in the shadow of the father, the king, the great predecessor, you cannot possibly project such a presence. As Machiavelli said, "But when they began to make sovereignty hereditary, the children quickly degenerated from their fathers. And, so far from trying to equal their father's virtues, they considered that a prince had nothing else to do than to excel all the rest in idleness, indulgence, and every other variety of pleasure." Observance of the Law. Alexander the Great had a dominant passion as a young man, an intense dislike for his father, King Philip of Macedonia. He hated Philip's cunning, cautious style of ruling, his bombastic speeches, his drinking and whoring, and his love of wrestling and other wastes of time. Alexander knew he had to make himself the very opposite of his domineering father. He would force himself to be bold and reckless. He would control his tongue and be a man of few words, and he would not lose precious time in pursuit of pleasures that brought no glory. Alexander also resented the fact that Philip had conquered most of Greece. "My father will go on conquering till there is nothing extraordinary left for me to do," he once complained. While other sons of powerful men were content to inherit wealth and live a life of leisure, Alexander wanted only to outdo his father, to obliterate Philip's name from history by surpassing his accomplishments. Alexander itched to show others how superior he was to his father. A Thessalian horse dealer once brought a prize horse named Bucephalus to sell to Philip. None of the king's grooms could get near the horse. It was far too savage. And Philip berated the merchant for bringing him such a useless beast. Watching the whole affair, Alexander scowled and commented, "What a horse they are losing for want of skill and spirit to manage him." When he had said this several times, Philip had finally had enough, and challenged him to take on the horse. He called the merchant back, secretly hoping his son would have a nasty fall and learn a bitter lesson. But Alexander was the one to teach the lesson. Not only did he mount Bucephalus, he managed to ride him at full gallop, taming the horse that would later carry him all the way to India. The courtiers applauded wildly, but Philip seethed inside, not seeing a son but a rival to his power. Alexander's defiance of his father grew bolder. One day the two men had a heated argument before the entire court, and Philip drew his sword as if to strike his son. Having drunk too much wine, however, the king stumbled. Alexander pointed at his father and jeered, "Men of Macedonia, see there the man who is preparing to pass from Europe to Asia. He cannot pass from one table to another without falling." When Alexander was 18, a disgruntled courtier murdered Philip. As word of the regicide spread through Greece, city after city rose up in rebellion against their Macedonian rulers. Philip's advisors counseled Alexander, now the king, to proceed cautiously, to do as Philip had done and conquer through cunning. But Alexander would do things his way. He marched to the furthest reaches of the kingdom, suppressed the rebellious towns, and reunited the empire with brutal efficiency. As a young rebel grows older, his struggle against his father often wanes, and he gradually comes to resemble the very man he had wanted to defy. But Alexander's loathing of his father did not end with Philip's death. Once he had consolidated Greece, he set his eyes on Persia, the prize that had eluded his father, who had dreamed of conquering Asia. If he defeated the Persians, Alexander would finally surpass Philip in glory and fame. Alexander crossed into Asia with an army of 35,000 to face a Persian force numbering over 1 million. Before engaging the Persians in battle, he passed through the town of Gordium. Here, in the town's main temple, there stood an ancient chariot tied with cords made of the rind of the cornel tree. Legend had it that any man who could undo these cords, the Gordian knot, would rule the world. Many had tried to untie the enormous and intricate knot, but none had succeeded. Alexander, seeing he couldn't possibly untie the knot with his bare hands, took out his sword and with one slash cut it in half. This symbolic gesture showed the world that he would not do as others, but would blaze his own path. Against astounding odds, Alexander conquered the Persians. Most expected him to stop there. It was a great triumph, enough to secure his fame for eternity. But Alexander had the same relationship to his own deeds as he had to his father. His conquest of Persia represented the past, and he wanted never to rest on past triumphs, or to allow the past to outshine the present. He moved on to India, extending his empire beyond all known limits. Only his disgruntled and weary soldiers prevented him from going farther. Interpretation. Alexander represents an extremely uncommon type in history. The son of a famous and successful man who manages to surpass the father in glory and power. The reason this type is uncommon is simple. The father most often manages to amass his fortune, his kingdom, because he begins with little or nothing. A desperate urge impels him to succeed. He has nothing to lose by cunning and impetuousness, and has no famous father of his own to compete against. This kind of man has reason to believe in himself, to believe that his way of doing things is the best, because after all, it worked for him. When a man like this has a son, he becomes domineering and oppressive, imposing his lessons on the son, who is starting off life in circumstances totally different from those in which the father himself began. Instead of allowing the son to go in a new direction, the father will try to put him in his own shoes, perhaps secretly wishing the boy will fail, as Philip half wanted to see Alexander thrown from Bucephalus. Fathers envy their son's youth and vigor, after all, and their desire is to control and dominate. The sons of such men tend to become cowed and cautious, terrified of losing what their fathers have gained. The son will never step out of his father's shadow unless he adopts the ruthless strategy of Alexander. Disparage the past. Create your own kingdom. Put the father in the shadows instead of letting him do the same to you. If you cannot materially start from ground zero, it would be foolish to renounce an inheritance, you can at least begin from ground zero psychologically, by throwing off the weight of the past and charting a new direction. Alexander instinctively recognized that privileges of birth are impediments to power. Be merciless with the past, then, not only with your father and his father, but with your own earlier achievements. Only the weak rest on their laurels and dote on past triumphs. In the game of power, there is never time to rest. Keys to power. In many ancient kingdoms, for example, Bengal and Sumatra, after the king had ruled for several years, his subjects would execute him. This was done partly as a ritual of renewal, but also to prevent him from growing too powerful. For the king would generally try to establish a permanent order, at the expense of other families and of his own sons. Instead of protecting the tribe and leading it in times of war, he would attempt to dominate it. And so he would be beaten to death, or executed in an elaborate ritual. Now that he was no longer around for his honors to go to his head, he could be worshipped as a god. Meanwhile, the field had been cleared for a new and youthful order to establish itself. The ambivalent, hostile attitude towards the king or father figure also finds expression in legends of heroes who didn't know their father. Moses, the archetypal man of power, was found abandoned among the bulrushes, and never knew his parents. Without a father to compete with him or limit him, he could attain the heights of power. Hercules had no earthly father. He was the son of the god Zeus. Later in his life, Alexander the Great spread the story that the god Jupiter Ammon had sired him, not Philip of Macedon. Legends and rituals like these eliminate the human father, because he symbolizes the destructive power of the past. The past prevents the young hero from creating his own world. He must do as his father did, even after his father is dead or powerless. The hero must bow and scrape before his predecessor and yield to tradition and precedent. What had success in the past must be carried over to the present, even though circumstances have greatly changed. The past also weighs the hero down with an inheritance that he is terrified of losing, making him timid and cautious. Power depends on the ability to fill a void, to occupy a field that has been cleared of the dead weight of the past. Only after the father figure has been properly done away with will you have the necessary space to create and establish a new order. There are several strategies you can adopt to accomplish this. Variations on the execution of the king that disguise the violence of the impulse by channeling it in socially acceptable forms. Perhaps the simplest way to escape the shadow of the past is simply to belittle it, playing on the timeless antagonism between the generations, stirring up the young against the old. For this you need a convenient older figure to pillory. Mao Zedong, confronting a culture that fiercely resisted change, played on the suppressed resentment against the overbearing presence of the venerable Confucius in Chinese culture. John F. Kennedy knew the dangers of getting lost in the past. He radically distinguished his presidency from that of his predecessor, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and also from the preceding decade, the 1950s, which Eisenhower personified. Kennedy, for instance, would not play the dull and fatherly game of golf, a symbol of retirement and privilege, and Eisenhower's passion. Instead, he played football on the White House lawn. In every aspect, his administration represented vigor and youth, as opposed to the stodgy Eisenhower. Kennedy had discovered an old truth. The young are easily set against the old, since they yearn to make their own place in the world and resent the shadow of their fathers. The distance you establish from your predecessor often demands some symbolism, a way of advertising itself publicly. Louis XIV, for example, created such symbolism when he rejected the traditional palace of the French kings and built his own palace of Versailles. King Philip II of Spain did the same when he created his center of power, the palace of El Escorial, in what was then the middle of nowhere. But Louis carried the game further. He would not be a king like his father or earlier ancestors. He would not wear a crown or carry a scepter or sit on a throne. He would establish a new kind of imposing authority with symbols and rituals of its own. Louis made his ancestors' rituals into laughable relics of the past. Follow his example. Never let yourself be seen as following your predecessor's path. If you do, you will never surpass him. You must physically demonstrate your difference by establishing a style and symbolism that sets you apart. The Roman Emperor Augustus, successor to Julius Caesar, understood this thoroughly. Caesar had been a great general, a theatrical figure whose spectacles kept the Romans entertained, an international emissary seduced by the charms of Cleopatra, a larger-than-life figure. So Augustus, despite his own theatrical tendencies, competed with Caesar not by trying to outdo him, but by differentiating himself from him. He based his power on a return to Roman simplicity, an austerity of both style and substance. Against the memory of Caesar's sweeping presence, Augustus posed a quiet and manly dignity. The problem with the overbearing predecessor is that he fills the vistas before you with symbols of the past. You have no room to create your own name. To deal with the situation, you need to hunt out the vacuums, those areas in culture that have been left vacant and in which you can become the first and principal figure to shine. When Pericles of Athens was about to launch a career as a statesman, he looked for the one thing that was missing in Athenian politics. Most of the great politicians of his time had allied themselves with the aristocracy. Indeed, Pericles himself had aristocratic tendencies. Yet he decided to throw in his hat with the city's democratic elements. The choice had nothing to do with his personal beliefs, but it launched him on a brilliant career. Out of necessity, he became a man of the people. Instead of competing in an arena filled with great leaders, both past and present, he would make a name for himself where no shadows could obscure his presence. When the painter Diego de Velázquez began his career, he knew he couldn't compete in refinement and technique with the great Renaissance painters who had come before him. Instead, he chose to work in a style that by the standards of the time seemed coarse and rough, in a way that had never been seen before. And in this style, he excelled. There were members of the Spanish court who wanted to demonstrate their own break with the past. The newness of Velázquez's style thrilled them. Most people are afraid to break so boldly with tradition, but they secretly admire those who can break up the old forms and reinvigorate the culture. This is why there is so much power to be gained from entering vacuums and voids. There is a kind of stubborn stupidity that recurs throughout history, and is a strong impediment to power. The superstitious belief that if the person before you succeeded by doing A, B, and C, you can recreate their success by doing the same thing. This cookie-cutter approach will seduce the uncreative, for it is easy and appeals to their timidity and their laziness. But circumstances never repeat themselves exactly. When General Douglas MacArthur assumed command of American forces in the Philippines during World War II, an assistant handed him a book containing the various precedents established by the commanders before him, the methods that had been successful for them. MacArthur asked the assistant how many copies there were of this book. 6, the assistant answered. Well, the general replied, you get all those 6 copies together and burn them, every one of them. I'll not be bound by precedents. Anytime a problem comes up, I'll make the decision at once, immediately. Adopt this ruthless strategy toward the past. Burn all the books, and train yourself to react to circumstances as they happen. You may believe that you have separated yourself from the predecessor or father figure, but as you grow older, you must be eternally vigilant lest you become the father you had rebelled against. As a young man, Mao Zedong disliked his father, and in the struggle against him, found his own identity and a new set of values. But as he aged, his father's ways crept back in. Mao's father had valued manual work over intellect. Mao had scoffed at this as a young man, but as he grew older, he unconsciously returned to his father's views and echoed such outdated ideas by forcing a whole generation of Chinese intellectuals into manual labor, a nightmarish mistake that cost his regime dearly. Remember, you are your own father. Do not let yourself spend years creating yourself only to let your guard down and allow the ghost of the past, father, habit, history, to sneak back in. Finally, as noted in the story of Louis XV, plenitude and prosperity tend to make us lazy and inactive. When our power is secure, we have no need to act. This is a serious danger, especially for those who achieve success and power at an early age. The playwright Tennessee Williams, for instance, found himself skyrocketed from obscurity to fame by the success of The Glass Menagerie. The sort of life which I had had previous to this popular success, he later wrote, was one that required endurance, a life of clawing and scratching. But it was a good life, because it was the sort of life for which the human organism is created. I was not aware of how much vital energy had gone into this struggle until the struggle was removed. This was security at last. I sat down and looked about me, and was suddenly very depressed. Williams had a nervous breakdown, which may in fact have been necessary for him. Pushed to the psychological edge, he could start writing with the old vitality again, and he produced A Streetcar Named Desire. Fyodor Dostoevsky, similarly, whenever he wrote a successful novel, would feel that the financial security he had gained made the act of creation unnecessary. He would take his entire savings to the casino and would not leave until he had gambled away his last penny. Once reduced to poverty, he could write again. It's not necessary to go to such extremes, but you must be prepared to return to square one psychologically, rather than growing fat and lazy with prosperity. Pablo Picasso could deal with success, but only by constantly changing the style of his painting, often breaking completely with what had made him successful before. How often our early triumphs turn us into a kind of caricature of ourselves. Powerful people recognize these traps. Like Alexander the Great, they struggle constantly to recreate themselves. The father must not be allowed to return. He must be slain at every step of the way. Reversal. The shadow of a great predecessor could be used to advantage if it is chosen as a trick, a tactic that can be discarded once it has brought you power. Napoleon III used the name and legend of his illustrious granduncle Napoleon Bonaparte to help him become first president and then emperor of France. Once on the throne, however, he didn't stay tied to the past. He quickly showed how different his reign would be, and was careful to keep the public from expecting him to attain the heights that Bonaparte had attained. The past often has elements worth appropriating, qualities that it would be foolish to reject out of a need to distinguish yourself. Even Alexander the Great recognized and was influenced by his father's skill in organizing an army. Making a display of doing things differently from your predecessor can make you seem childish and, in fact, out of control, unless your actions have a logic of their own. Joseph II, son of the Austrian Empress Maria Theresa, made a show of doing the exact opposite of his mother, dressing like an ordinary citizen, staying in inns instead of palaces, appearing as the people's emperor. Maria Theresa, on the other hand, had been regal and aristocratic. The problem was that she had also been beloved, an empress who ruled wisely after years of learning the hard way. If you have the kind of intelligence and instinct that will point you in the right direction, playing the rebel will not be dangerous. But if you're mediocre, as Joseph II was in comparison to his mother, you are better off learning from your predecessor's knowledge and experience, which are based on something real. Finally, it is often wise to keep an eye on the young, your future rivals in power. Just as you try to rid yourself of your father, they will soon play the same trick on you, denigrating everything you have accomplished. Just as you rise by rebelling against the past, keep an eye on those rising from below, and never give them the chance to do the same to you. The great Baroque artist and architect Pietro Bernini was a master at sniffing out younger potential rivals and keeping them in his shadow. One day a young stonemason named Francesco Borromini showed Bernini his architectural sketches. Recognizing his talent immediately, Bernini instantly hired Borromini as his assistant, which delighted the young man, but was actually only a tactic to keep him close at hand, so that he could play psychological games on him and create in him a kind of inferiority complex. And indeed, despite Borromini's brilliance, Bernini has the greater fame. His strategy with Borromini he made a lifelong practice. Fearing that the great sculptor Alessandro Algardi, for example, would eclipse him in fame, he arranged it so that Algardi could only find work as his assistant. And any assistant who rebelled against Bernini and tried to strike out on his own would find his career ruined. Here are some further reflections on this law. From A Pocket Mirror for Heroes by Baltasar Gracian. The excellence of being first. Many would have shone like the very phoenix in their occupations if others had not preceded them. Being first is a great advantage. With eminence, twice as good. Deal the first hand and you will win the upper ground. Those who go first win fame by right of birth, and those who follow are like second sons, contenting themselves with meager portions. Solomon opted wisely for pacifism, yielding warlike things to his father. By changing course, he found it easier to become a hero. And our great Philip II governed the entire world from the throne of his prudence, astonishing the ages. If his unconquered father was a model of energy, Philip was a paradigm of prudence. This sort of novelty has helped the well-advised win a place in the role of the great. Without leaving their own art, the ingenious leave the common path and take, even in professions gray with age, new steps toward eminence. Horace yielded epic poetry to Virgil, and Martial the lyric to Horace. Terence opted for comedy, Perseus for satire, each hoping to be the first in his genre. Bold fancy never succumbed to facile imitation. From Plutarch's Life of Pericles. As a young man, Pericles was inclined to shrink from facing the people. One reason for this was that he was considered to bear a distinct resemblance to the tyrant Pisistratus. And when men who were well on in years remarked on the charm of Pericles' voice and the smoothness and fluency of his speech, they were astonished at the resemblance between the two. The fact that he was rich and that he came of a distinguished family and possessed exceedingly powerful friends made the fear of ostracism very real to him. And at the beginning of his career, he took no part in politics, but devoted himself to soldiering, in which he showed great daring and enterprise. However, the time came when Aristides was dead, Themistocles in exile, and Cimon frequently absent on distant campaigns. Then, at last, Pericles decided to